Chapter 21. Death at St. Ezra's. The Long Hunt. The Cell of Five. Precisely how he had found me was a mystery, but I believe he had been on my tail for a long time, since before Kinchare. The fact that he had come to St. Ezra outlooking at that hour and that day convinced me that he had intercepted my communicator Gladys. And he might have triumphed over me, right there, right then, if he'd but pressed the advantage and finished the job with his bolt gun. Instead, Tantalid holstered his bolt pistol and drew his ancient chainsword, Theophantus, intent on delivering formal execution with the holy weapon. I fired my las pistol, powering shot after shot at him, driving him backwards. His gold-chased battlesuit, which gave his shriveled frame the bulk and proportions of a space marine, absorbed or deflected the impacts, but the sheer force knocked him back several paces. I jumped up, firing again, and retreating down the epistle side of the cathedral, towards the feretry. Bystanders and church servants were still fleeing. Its iron teeth singing, Theophantus swung at me. Tantalid was barking out the accusal of heresy, verse after verse. "Be quiet," I yelled, enforcing my will. The psychic sting shocked him into silence, but he was generally protected by psi dampers and ignored my next will-driven order to desist completely. The chainsword revved around, and I threw myself aside as it cleft a bench pew in two. The backswing nearly caught me, but I dodged behind a pier column that took the force of the blow in a splintering shower of sparks and stone chippings. Ungish was still crying out in pain. The sound chilled and infuriated me. I fired my las pistol again, but the last few shots fizzed and spluttered, underpowered. The power cell was exhausted. I dived again, feinting past his slow-moving bulk, and grappled with him from behind. It was a desperate ploy. Unarmored as I was, I stood little chance of overwhelming his brute force or hurting him. He got a steel-gloved paw round behind himself, grabbed me by the coat, and tore me off him. My coat ripped. I bounced hard off a pillar and crashed awkwardly through the delicate fretwork of a confessional screen. I had barely pulled myself out of the flimsy wooden wreckage when the chainsword swooped in again and chewed a deep gouge in the cathedral floor. I ran from him then, across the south aisle, towards the feretory. Two men of the cathedral's frateris militia, clearly seeking advancement by coming to the aid of the fearsome ministorum witch-hunter, closed in to block my escape. They were both clad in Ezra's yellow and carried short stave maces in one hand and temple lanterns in the other. I think they both quickly regretted their enthusiastic involvement. I didn't even bother with the will. I think my rage was too great to have used it cleanly anyway. I sidestepped the first mace, caught and broke the wrist that wielded it, and kicked the man down. The mace turned in the air as it flew from the sprawling oaf's useless hand, and I caught it and turned it crosswise in time to block the downstroke of the other man's club. As he bounced back with the recoil of his own negated strike, I smacked him in the side of the knee with my captured weapon. He fell over with a sharp wail of pain, losing hold of his own mace and trying to beat me with his temple lamp instead. I took the lamp away from him and kicked him in the belly so he doubled up on his side, sobbing and trying to remember how to breathe. The first man was back up, running at me. I spun and smashed the temple lamp in his face, sideways. Both its light and his went out. The paving shook as Tantalid hove down on me. I used the captured mace like a sword, double-handed, to deflect his first strokes. It was iron-banded hardwood and tough, but no match for a chainsword. After two or three clashes, the mace was chewed and mangled. I threw it aside and tore a church standard down from the wall beside the feretory door. Theophantus immediately shredded the old embroidered cloth and wood-framed titulus from the end, but that left me with 3 meters of cast iron pole. I held it like a quarterstaff, striking Tantalid hard on the side of the head with one end, and then square on the opposite hip with the other. Then I stabbed the end at him viciously, like a spear thrust, and managed to dent the chest plate of his armour. In response, and frothing mad with anger himself now, he put up Theophantus and shortened my pole by about 0.5 meter. I wrenched the remaining pole around one-handed and struck him on the other side of the head. Blood was spilling from his ears. He howled and made an attack that almost took my arm off. My third attempt to clip his miserable head missed. He was wise to it now and blocked with his chainsword. The chain teeth caught in the pole and plucked it from my hands, throwing it up 10 meters into the air. It landed behind some pews with a loud, echoing clang. I rocked back from the follow-up, but the murderous saw caught my right shoulder and gashed me deeply. Clutching the wound, I ducked again, and Theophantus decapitated a statue of St. Ezra's partner. No matter what I did, it was going his way. He had the weapons and the armor on his side. And now I was bleeding badly, which meant I would progressively slow and weaken, and it was just a matter for him to keep pressing the onslaught and he would triumph. I became aware of another commotion near the main doors of the great church. Many startled worshippers and hierarchs had retreated and gathered there to watch the holy combat. Now they were spilling aside, their huddle breaking. A figure stormed through them. Medea. She ran down the main aisle, calling to me, firing her needle pistol over the tops of the pews at Tantalid. The lethal rounds pinged and clicked off his armor, and he turned in annoyance. Tantalid dragged out his bolt pistol and fired at this new attack. Medea hurled the object she had been carrying in her other hand, and then disappeared from view as she dived to evade the hammer blows of the bolt rounds. At least I prayed it was a deliberate dive. If he had hit her. The object she had thrown bounced off a pew near me and landed on the floor, spilling from its yellow cloth. Barbarisata. Risking dismemberment from the chainsword, I hurled myself at the Carthaean blade. My hands found its long grip, and I rolled twice to avoid the next downstrike of Theophantus. Barbarisata purred in my grip as I came up. The runes blazed with vengeful light. Tantalid realized that the nature of the battle had suddenly changed. I saw it in his eyes. My first swing severed his wrist, cutting clean through the power-armored cuff, dropping his hand to the floor, still clutching the smoking bolt gun. My second met Theophantus and destroyed it, spraying disintegrating chain teeth and machine parts into the air. My third cut Witchfinder Tantalid in two, from the left shoulder to the groin. Neither half of him made a sound as they fell apart onto the cathedral floor. Barbarisata was still seething with power and twitched as Medea emerged unhurt from behind a choir stall. I forced the hungry blade down. "Come on," she said. Ungish was dead. There was nothing I could do for her. And there was so much I should have done. She had been right. Right about this. Right about her fate. I dreaded to think how much more of what she had said might prove to be true, too. Hearing my frantic glossier call when Tantalid first attacked, Medea had taken the launch up from Ezra Plain outside the city, despite all official warnings for her to abort, and flown it right in, setting down in the courtyard outside St. Ezra Outlooking. As we ran out now, into the evening, through crowds of stunned onlookers who leapt out of the way, the city Arbites and the Fratris militia were rising in alarmed response. There was no point waiting to face them. The launch shot us skywards, back towards the Essen, to leave Orbal Infanta as fast as we could. It was a mess, and I was terribly disheartened. The confidence with which we had all set out from King Chair seemed to have dissolved. Orbal Infanta had been just the first part of a long stratagem, and thanks to Tantalid, it had ended badly. I'd failed to contact Gladys, and discovered that, as careful as I had been, my communiques were not secure. The third task I had planned to undertake on Orbal Infanta, a search of the Imperial Archivum for certain information relating to Quixos, hadn't even been started. At least the weapons were consecrated, and Barbarisata had more than proved itself in combat. Frigates of the Fratris militia, along with several Imperial Navy guard boats, attempted to block the SN, but Maxilla's navigator got us out of the system and real space before they could even close range. Some ships pursued us into the warp, and we were chased for 8 days, finally losing our pursuers through a series of real space decelerations and redirections. We went aground. A month at a low-tech depot on a farming world, another 2 at the automated station at Quile. I was jumping at shadows by then, expecting enemies and rivals to loom out of every doorway. But it was quiet, and we were unmolested. Maxilla had made a career out of passing unnoticed and avoiding attention. He lent that practiced art to our cause now, and reassured me into the bargain. 3 months after leaving Orbal Infanta in such haste, we risked a run to Glorisant, an outlying but prosperous trade world in the Antimar subsector, another division of the Scarus sector, just 2 subsectors over from the Helican sub itself. Though worlds like Gudrun and Thracian Primaris were a good 4 months away by starship, it felt a little like being home. Disguised, Medea and I visited the sea-lashed stone piles of one of the main trade hives, and procured a pair of astropaths, hiring their services from the local commercial guild on an open-ended lease. Their names were Adger and Yuli, both young males, both psychically capable but dull-witted and emotionless. Their young heads were shaved and their plugs shiny and new, and they spoke to me in overly formal ways that sounded like the parrot-learned etiquette it sadly was. But their eyes were ringed with darkness, and their flesh was losing its youthful luster. The rigor of the astropathic life was already taking its toll. Using them, I sent fresh communiques that superseded the original ones and revised certain aspects of my scheme. None of the messages now suggested the sort of trial meetings I had attempted with Gladys. I would not give so much away now. After a week and no responses, we left Glorisent and went, via Mimonon, to Sarum, the capital world of the Antimar subsector. I managed to do some useful work in its libraries, but backed off when a sour little confessor on a research sabbatical took to following me as if he recognized me. While at anchor off Sarum, I got my first responses, all coded, from Bequin on Messina and from Amos on Gudrun. Both reported that their parts of the plan were going much more smoothly than mine had. 2 days later, a partially scrambled astropathic message came from Inchebel on Elvara Cardinal. What parts I got of it seemed to indicate some success. I was impatient to know more. The week before we left Sarum, I received two more, both anonymous, one from Thracian Primaris, the other from a cluster of slave worlds that owed fealty to the Sales province of the Ophidian subsector. From the careful code and language of both, I recognized their senders. My spirits lifted. After that improvement, things again seemed to slow and stagnate. There was no progress and no further communications. We were forced to quit Lorwen, our next stop after Sarum, with unseemly haste, when a flotilla of warships from Battlefleet Reaver arrived. I know now that the Battlefleet manoeuvres at Lorwen, and incidentally at Sarum and Femis Major II, were part of a major precautionary deployment against a pair of space hulks that had suddenly roamed into the subsector. But they caused us over 13 weeks of anxious hiding amongst the brown and black dwarf stars of an extinguished stellar nursery. Another Candlemas went by while we were in the Empyrean, en route to the Drulian group. Medea, Maxilla, and I marked it together, just the three of us. The two astropaths and the navigator were not invited to attend. I raised a glass to toast the continued success of our mission. I don't think I would have been so hearty if I had known it would be another full year before the final act of the plan would play out. I spent the first 4 months of 342 fruitlessly engaged in a search for the celebrated precog hermit Lucas Cassian in the stinking marshes of Drulia II, only to learn that he had been murdered by a monodominant cult 4 years earlier. During that quest, I terminated the activities of a plague demon sect infesting the marshlands. That was quite an undertaking in its own right, but my full account of it is filed in the Inquisition archives separately, and it has no bearing on this record. Besides, I still regard it bitterly as an interruption and waste of time. Neither will I set down here the full story of Nathan Inchebel's ventures on Elvara Cardinal, or Harlan Nail's frankly extraordinary experiences on Bimus Tertius, though both tales connect to this record. Inchebel has written his own refreshingly witty account of his exploits, which may be accessed by those with the appropriate clearance, something I recommend as illuminating and rewarding. Nail asked me not to include his story, and has never committed it to record. It may be learned only by those with the temerity to ask him, and the money to pay for a long night's serious drinking. All this while I remained an imperial outlaw, wanted by the Inquisition for my heresies. It is interesting to note that at no time during this period did the Inquisition formally refute or overturn the Carta I had declared on Quixos. The year 343.M41 was half gone already by the time the SN took me to Thessalon, a feudal world near Hesperus in the Helican subsector. It had been chosen by Nail as the point for our secret congregation. Commanding a 20-man field team selected from my staff on Gudrun, he arrived a week before the rest of us to secure the location and make sure we were not compromised. His preparations were thorough and ingenious. No one entered the area without him knowing it, nor could anyone have done so. At the slightest sign of outside interruption or official interference, we would have ample time to withdraw and flee. As a final precaution, I was the last to arrive. Thessalon is a tough little world, whose population lives in a dark age, and knows nothing of the Imperium, or the galaxy beyond its skies. The meeting place was a ruined keep in the north of the second continent, 2,000 kilometers from the nearest indigenous community. A few lonely animal herders and subsistence farmers undoubtedly saw the lights of our ships in their heavens, but to them they were just the portents of the gods and the bright eyes of fabulous beasts. Medea deposited me at the edge of a conifer forest at nightfall, and then took the gun cutter back to stand off as air cover, ready to redeploy at a moment's notice. For the first time in over 2 standard years, I was dressed as an inquisitor, in black leather, storm coat, and proudly displayed rosette. I also wore my faith harness with the engraving Puritas. Damn anyone who believed I wasn't worthy of it. Nail, in combat armor, with a laser carbine cradled over one arm, appeared out of the trees and greeted me. We shook hands. It was good to see him again. His men, who were all around, I was sure, were invisible in the gathering darkness. Nail led me through the black woods into a break in the trees, where the pine tops framed a perfect oval of star-filled mauve. The keep, a jumbled pile of grey stone, stood in the clearing, with hooded lamps glowing from the lower slit windows. Nail walked me past and around the alarm sensors, the tripwires and the beams of motion detectors that webbed the structure. Servitor skulls from my personal arsenal hovered in the shadows, alert and armed. Beckwin and Amos met me under the broken entrance arch. Amos looked pale and worried, but his face broke into a warm smile as he saw me. Beckwin hugged me. "How many?" I asked her.
4, she said.
"Not bad. Not great, but not bad. It rather depended who those 4 were. And everything else?"
"All the preparations are now set. We can begin this undertaking at any time," Amos said.
"We have a target?"
"We do. You'll learn how when we brief everyone."
"Good." I paused. "Anything else I should know?" All 3 of them shook their heads. "Let's do it then," I said. Despite all the precautions, I was taking my life in my hands. I was presenting myself voluntarily to 4 members of the Inquisition. I was trusting that my previous friendships and allegiances with them would count for more than the accusations Ozma had laid at my door. These 4 were the only 4 who had responded out of the original 20 communiques. Nail had vetted each one, but there was still a very real chance that any or all of them had attended simply to execute the declared heretic, Gregor Eisenhorn. I would soon know. As I stepped into the main candlelit chamber, a hush killed the small talk, and 6 men turned to face me. Fischig, imposing in black body armor, nodded me a half-smile. Interrogator Inchibel, in a body glove and lightweight cloak, bowed his head and smiled nervously. The other 4 stared at me levelly. I walked into their midst solemnly. The first lowered the hood of his maroon cape. It was Titus Endor.
"Hello, Gregor," he said.
"Well met, old friend." Endor had been one of the first 2 to contact me anonymously the previous year, from the Sales slave worlds. The other, who had ridden from Thracian Primaris, stood next to him.
"Commandus Vogue, you honour me with your presence."
The wizened old wretch sneered at me.
"For the sake of our history, and damn his eyes, Lyco, and other matters, I am here, Eisenhorn. Though the Emperor knows I am very suspicious of this. I will hear you out, and if I don't like what you have to say, I will withdraw, without breaking the confidence of this meeting," he added sternly with a raised finger. "I will not betray this Congress, but I reserve the right to leave and quit if I find it worthless."
"That right is yours, Commodus." To his left stood a tall, confident man I didn't recognize. He wore brown leather flak armor under a long blue coat of cavalry twill, and his silver rosette was fixed on the left breast. His domed head was shaved, but there was a violet glint in his eyes that told me he was Acadian.
"Inquisitor Raum Grumman," said Fischig, stepping forward.
Grumman took my proffered hand with a curt nod.
"Inquisitor General Neve acknowledges your communique to her, and asks me to express her true sadness that she could not join you here. She personally requested me to take her place, and render you the service I freely render her."
"I am grateful for it, Grumman. But right from the start, I want to be sure that you know what we're about here. Just being here because your provincial chief requested it isn't enough." The Cadian smiled.
"Actually, it is. But, to reassure you, I have reviewed the matter carefully with Neve herself and your man Fischig.
I have no illusions about the danger of being here and siding with you. Given the evidence, I would have been here anyway.
Good. Excellent. Welcome, Grubman. The identity of the fourth and final guest took me aback. He was clad in polished battle-wear plating that looked custom-made and exorbitantly expensive. With gauntleted hands, he lifted the scowling houndskull helmet off his head. Inquisitor Massimo Ricci, of the Helican Ordo Xenos. He was hardly an old friend, but I knew him well.
Ricci?
His handsome, haughty face displayed a wide smile.
Like Grumman, I am here to extend apologies from another. For numerous reasons that I'm sure you can appreciate, Lord Rorkan cannot answer your request in person. It would be political suicide for him to participate in this matter, but my lord has faith in you still, Eisenhorn. He has sent me to act as his proxy.
Ricci was one of Lord Rorkan's most valued and admired inquisitors. Many said he was a likely successor for the post as a master of the Ordo Xenos. For him to be here was an enormous compliment, both from Lord Rorkan, who had seen fit to send one of his most illustrious men, and from Ricci himself, who was risking a high-profile career just by being here. Clearly, both of them had taken my proposal and cause very seriously.
"Gentlemen," I said, "I am pleased and honoured to see you all. Let us discuss this matter freely and openly, and see where we stand."
The Thessalonian night winds moaned through the ruined cavities of the keep as I briefed them. Inchabel and Nail had carried chairs in and erected a heavy trestle table. Beckwin and Amos provided data slates, charts, papers, and other pieces of evidence as I called for them. I talked for about 2 hours, taking them through the entire matter of Quixos as it was known to me. Much of what I said had been laid out in the initial communiques, but I filled in all the details and answered questions as they arose. Endor seemed satisfied and hardly spoke. It was good to have a true friend here, one who simply trusted my word and purpose. Grumman was also generally noncommittal. Voke and Ricci asked plenty of questions and required clarification on the smallest points. All three Ordos were represented around that table. Voke was Ordo Malleus, though thankfully not a tight member of Bezier's inner circle. Ricci and I were Ordo Xenos, and Grumman and Endor were Ordo Hereticus. All of us, apart from Grumman, were assigned servants of the Ordos Inquisitori Helican. Only Titus Endor, who I knew to be famously demure, wasn't wearing his rosette openly. I believe I spoke eloquently and well. We broke after 2 hours to stretch our legs, ruminate, and take refreshment. I went outside, taking in the cold night air, listening to the wind swish the conifers. Fischig joined me and brought me a glass of wine.
"It's bad with Neve," he said, just getting right into it.
He had travelled back to Cadia from Kincher to collect more data and to specifically recruit the Inquisitor General.
"Because of me," he nodded.
"Because of everything. Ozma made big trouble after we sprung you from the Carnificina. He had the combined clout of Bezier and Orsini behind him after all. That made Neve's superior, Grandmaster Nunthum of the Ordos Cadia, sit up and take notice, I can tell you. They were after her for her job, but they couldn't prove a thing. Neve's very good at being slippery, and she fought your corner like a she-bear, too, believe you me."
"She's safe."
"Yeah. Thanks to a massive incursion of the enemy 8 months ago. The Cadian gates on a war footing and utterly in turmoil. Last thing anyone's worrying about is what part Neve may have played in the Eisenhorn conspiracy."
"That's what they're calling it."
"That's what they're calling it."
I sipped the wine, expecting something rough and local. It turned out to be a damn good Samaritan red. From my own cellars, I guessed. Beckwin would have taken care of such things and chosen the very best to mollify our guests. "Grumman, what do you make of him?"
"I've got plenty of time for him, Gregor," Fischig said. "Smart mind, knows what he's doing. Given the scrutiny she was under, Neve knew she couldn't get away, so she picked Grumman, and I don't think she would have if he wasn't worth his salt. The pair go back a long way, and Grumman's doing this out of respect for her. But we spent a long time talking on the voyage back here, and I think he's in it for himself now, too."
"Good. The others?"
"Voke's full of surprises," he snorted. "When you said he was going to be on your list of contacts, I thought you were mad. Not as mad as writing to Lord Rorkan, of course, but anyway. I never thought the old bastard would show, or even deign to answer you. He's so stiff even the rod up his arse has got a rod up its arse.
That's one bet I would have lost. He must like you more than he lets on. We have an understanding, I said. I'd saved Vogue's life on the flagship St. Sithus, but he'd returned that favour on the avenue of the Victor Bellum. Maybe that was enough.
He needs convincing, said Fischig, but I think he's in for the long haul.
You do?
You see that creep Haldane anywhere?
I knew what Fischig meant. Haldane would have opposed this mission without question, and taken great delight in bringing me in, dead or alive. Vogue had clearly come here without his old pupil knowing. Fischig was right. That was a good sign.
Endor, well, he's safe, isn't he? Said Fischig. Given your history, he'd have come anyway.
It's good to have him here. What about Ricci? Fischig's voice suddenly dropped to a hiss.
Speaking of whom?
He withdrew. Clutching a goblet of wine, Ricci walked out of the archway behind us and joined me, gazing up at the staggeringly bright starfield.
I hope you realize how lucky you are, Ricci said.
Every day.
You took a risk contacting Lord Rorkin. He's always liked you, but given the current climate, liking you is a dangerous habit. He was at loggerheads with Bezier and Orsini over your case.
And still he sent you?
Let me be direct, Gregor. I think it will help. Lord Rorkin, may his fortunes multiply in the face of the God Emperor, sent me to assist you in the unmasking and destruction of the heretic Quixos. But if, along the way, I should discover anything that confirmed the generally believed allegations of your own heresy...
What?
I think you understand.
You're his hatchet man. You'll help me, but if I cross the line in your eyes, Rorkin has sanctioned you to execute me. He raised his glass.
I think we know where we stand.
We did. Now it made much more sense that Rorkin had sent so senior an agent to my side. I said nothing. Ricci smiled and went back inside. We sat down around the table again and debated some more. I found most of the questions, especially those from Vogue and Ricci, willfully small-minded. At last, after another hour, Grumman voiced a pertinent query.
Supposing we agree to this, agree that Eisenhorn is wrongly charged and that Quixos deserves our sternest censure, how do we do that? Do we know where Quixos is?
Yes, I said. Though I didn't know the answer myself. My people had enjoyed the best part of 2 years to do their work, many dozens of agents sifting data from hundreds of worlds. Unbidden, Beckwin stepped forward and took a seat with us at the table.
About 3 months ago, our research discerned a pattern in the data surrounding the near-mythical life of Quixos, and that pattern centered on Maginor.
Capital of the Naiades subsector, Viceroy sector, Ultima Segmentum,
announced Vogue.
Your astronomical knowledge is humbling, sir, Beckwin said smoothly.
She handed out data slates.
As you can see from the file of data marked Alpha, Quixos certainly visited Maginor almost 200 years ago and became involved with a cartel of trade interests and noble families known as the Mystic Path. The Path was a network which was already utilizing prohibited and forbidden lore and technologies. Quixos should have closed them down and burned them. It is clear he did not. Instead, he fed and supported them. He nurtured them until they became a power base for his invisible empire of dark belief. No longer a cartel, but a cult. A cult of Quixos.
Why do we think he's still there? Asked Ricci.
We think he's made his hidden fastness there, sir, said Beckwin. The reaches of the Mystic Path now spread throughout the Segmentum and beyond. Maginor is its heart. In 239.M41, Inquisitor Lugenbrow and a warrior band numbering some 60 individuals disappeared on Maginor. No trace of them was ever found, though Interrogator Inchabel was able to, recover an incomplete verbal transcript of a Pict recording apparently made during Lugenbrow's raid.
I speed-read the transcript. It was harrowing.
You got this from Elvara Cardinal, Inchabel? I asked.
Inchabel was at the back of the room. He stepped forward, blushing.
Not directly, sir. It actually came from the Inquisitorial Data Library on Phoebos Secundus. How is a damn good story, but it's probably wasting valuable time to repeat it just now.
Inchabel was right, as I have already said. It was a damn good story, and I enjoyed it when he told it to me later. I urge you to access it.
We believe Lugenbrow was hunting Quixos, although he may not have known it, continued Beckwin. He and his entire band were wiped out by Quixos's forces.
Lugenbrow,
murmured Vogue, setting his slate down and looking off into space.
I never met him, but he was a trusted pupil of my late comrade Inquisitor Pavel Huet. When Lugenbrow went missing, Huet took it hard. The loss shortened his life.
Vogue looked at me with his rheumy eyes.
If I wasn't decided before, Eisenhorn, I am now. Quixos must pay.
I agree, said Endor, tossing his slate onto the table and looking grim. At the very least, the Inquisition demands vengeance for this.
Maginor, then? Grumman asked.
It's still his base of operations, sir. We are sure of that, said Beckwin. And until a week ago, we were all set to prepare for a strike against Maginor. Then we received this.
She held up an astropathic transcript.
I will read it, if I may.
She carefully put on her half-moon glasses. They suited her, but I knew her vanity made her hate them. It said a lot about the situation that she was willing to wear them in front of these men.
It begins. Gregor, my friend, I have been kept up to date with the data concerning your quarry. It gives me something to do these winter afternoons. I agree that Maginor may be the seat of the evil, and certainly requires the attention of the Inquisition, but if you'll pardon me, I suggest that Maginor be left to the Ordo's Naiades. Using pointers Amos gave me, I have assessed the following. My full findings are on the data files attached below, but in short, I think you should be looking at Farnus Beta. Quixos's fascination with the pylons of Cadia made me think, you see. See below that I have traced massive stone-cutting orders to the limit world of Cerebos, which lies galactically south of Terra. The Masonic guilds of Cerebos are famously secretive about their contracts. They provide an inert, obsidian-like black glass stone called Cerebite, a beautiful substance that is in high demand right across the Imperium. Cerebite is, as far as reckoning goes, as close to the material used on Cadia for the pylons as it is possible to get. As I have said, the Masonic guilds are close about their contracts, but there is little hiding the transportation of a massive copy of one of those pylons by shipping guild bulklifter. 3/4 of a kilometre long and 1/4 square. Quixos has ordered the manufacture of a perfect copy of the Cadian pylons, and has had it shipped to Farnus Beta.
Beckwin paused and looked up at us.
If you've ever trusted my advice, trust this now, she continued. Quixos is on Farnus, and if you're going to stop him, it must be now. Your devoted friend and pupil, Gideon.
Gideon. Gideon Ravener. Crippled as he was, he had found this insight, which totally altered our plan of attack. I was speechless. I felt almost tearful.
There is a postscript, said Beckwin. He writes, The demon hosts will be your foulest problem. I know you are prepared, but I send you these, one for each of the 20 you have summoned.
Beckwin took off her half-moon glasses and rose. Nail brought in a crate and set it down on the table. Inside were 20 scrolls of demonic protection, each sealed inside a blessed tube of green marble, and 20 consecrated gold amulets of the God Emperor as a skeletal relic. It was so typical of Ravener to attend to such details. Nail handed them out, a heavy scroll tube and an amulet, to each of us.
I'm convinced, Richie said,
getting to his feet and hanging the amulet around his neck so that it hung between the purity seals of his armour. I'm glad. Grumman?
I'm with you, said the Cadian.
A toast, I said, raising my glass, to this cell of 5, and to the others who have assisted in getting us this far. Beckwin, Amos, Nail, Fishig, and Inchabel also saluted with their glasses. To Farnes Peter, to the end of Quixos. The 5 Inquisitors in the drafty keep clinked glasses.
Farnes Peter, said Ricci. Remind me, where is that?
In the throat of the Cadian Gate, said Grumman, right on the edge of the Eye of Terror.